Brethren, for the sake of you who were not present yesterday, I began by likening my assignment to going to your favorite restaurant and ordering the sampler plate. You cannot in one meal, at least within the bounds of moderation, eat everything on the menu, but a sampler plate gives you a taste of a few of the primary dishes that your favorite restaurant serves. My assignment with regard to the subject of parenthood is surely analogous to that experience. Last Lord's Day in the Sunday School Hour in Ballston Lake, we finished our 33rd message in this ongoing series on the subject of effective parenthood. We have probably 15 to 20 installments yet to go before this endeavor is completed. And your pastor directed me to excerpt parts of the menu I've been serving there over the last year or so, and to bring those parts in five sessions to you this weekend. Well, yesterday, to carry on this analogy, we ordered a few items off of the first part of the menu that's in your hand, that is Roman numeral 1, Principles of Parenthood, from the book of Proverbs. We are to take up now, as announced yesterday in this hour, under Roman numeral 2, the exposition of significant text. And with regard to what is my intent in this Sunday school hour, I want to further direct you to the final three pages of the handout. I believe final three pages, something like that. The pages headed in the back, Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21. Because it is these two texts that will be our concern in this first hour here on the Lord's Day. In Ephesians 6:4 and in Colossians 3:21, we find two towering and profound directives to parents given by the Apostle Paul. We can safely say that no treatment of the subject of parenthood, at least from a biblical perspective, could ever be called responsible or complete, which omitted these two complementary texts. In Ephesians 6:4, Paul says, "And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." And in the parallel and complementary text, in Colossians 3, "Fathers, do not exasperate your children, that they may not lose heart." Now, our simple approach in the first hour today will be first to do the work of interpretation. It is my purpose to interpret the first half of Ephesians 6:4 and then all of Colossians 3:21, following that with some words of application, and if time permits, return to the second half of Ephesians 6:4 and do a bit of interpretation there, followed by some applicatory thoughts. Well, beginning then in Ephesians 6:4, Paul begins this statement, as well as its parallel, with the address to fathers. The apostle lays upon the shoulders of fathers the primary responsibility for the rearing of children. Now, we might ask ourselves, why is that? And I want to respond in several ways. Why is it that in these two profound directives, fathers are addressed instead of mothers, or instead of parents? Well, I want to say in response to such a question, Paul addresses fathers not because he had forgotten the word for parents. Look back in verse 1 of the same chapter. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, The apostle had not suffered some temporary amnesia between verses 1 and 4. Further, the apostle gives his directive to fathers not because he had forgotten the word for mothers. Again, in this same chapter, verse 2, honor your father and mother. Again, the apostle had not suffered some fleeting amnesia as he concluded the writing of his letter to the Ephesians. Rather, Paul deliberately and purposely names fathers, not parents, not mothers, as those primarily responsible for the tasks that follow. I pause to note that in post-World War II America, this sounds rather strange upon the ears of our countrymen. And the reason is the typical home in the United States from the mid-20th century to this point has generally been occupied by a father whose narrow idea of his responsibility in the home is to earn a livelihood and pay the bills, and everything else is effectively and practically shoved off upon the mother. The wife and mother is thus responsible for the job of rearing the children. Dad goes to work. Dad brings home a paycheck, and mother attends to virtually everything else. If there is any hands-on parenting that goes on, generally in the American home of our generation, it is the mother who does it. But again here, in these two texts, Paul addresses fathers. And such a view was so embedded in the thinking of the apostle, that is, the thinking or the view that fathers are primarily responsible, that in 1 Thessalonians 2:11, when the apostle is seeking to demonstrate to the Thessalonians the nature of his ministry, he uses a communication vehicle that he confidently assumes has such a recognition factor, such a degree of understanding in the common mind, that when they hear it, they will know exactly what he means about his pastoral ministry to the church. He says in that text, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. He assumed that the Thessalonians were so familiar with hands-on, thoroughly tuned in and plugged in fatherhood that he could liken his ministry to what fathers did in Thessalonica with confidence that his readers would make the connection between that and the nature of his ministry to the church. Well, again, I raise the question, what is the rationale for this purposeful, deliberate address to fathers? It's not because he forgot the word for parents or mothers, but in a positive response to such a question, quickly let me add, Paul sets this responsibility upon the shoulders of fathers because, in the first place, fathers have been designated by God as the head of the household, and thus as the superior in the marriage relation and in the parental unit, they are responsible for the rearing of their children. Granted, fathers and the address to them does not eliminate the application of these directives to mothers. Granted, much comes to the mother in the way of delegation, but in our generation, we must get it squarely fixed in our thinking and feeling that the biblical teaching sets the man as the head of the household, and thus upon his shoulders is the responsibility for this work placed. A second reason in a positive sense that I would offer for this address to fathers is that fathers have a very strong tendency to drive their children to anger and exasperation. The very directives here in verses 4 in Colossians 3:21 are very prone to be violated, in particular by fathers. Mothers seem to have an extraordinary amount of patience and forbearance towards their children. Fathers, generally speaking, have much less than mothers. And as the mother is more prone to the indulgent fondness which allows a child to get his or her own way, so the father is more prone to an angry impatience and impulsiveness which, when vented, drives a child to angry exasperation. Fathers have a bent to provoke their children to anger. Fathers have a bent to exasperate and break the spirits of their sons and daughters. I would offer that's another part of the rationale for this seemingly unusual address to fathers. But then there is a third reason, and that is fathers also have a strong bent to be paternally negligent, to be paternally lazy, to be paternally preoccupied with all manner of lesser things in life. A father may neglect the kinds of hands-on parenting that is conveyed here in these texts by deliberately shoving off that kind of parenting upon the wife. He may neglect these directives simply by default. He becomes so involved in other things, in his work, in his hobbies, in his various personal pursuits, that he simply has no time, nor no energy, no interest in his children. He rarely ever sees them. He is seldom at home. And when he is at home, he's too tired and too preoccupied and too this and too that. He thinks he has enough pressure upon himself, enough problems at work, and thus he refuses to take up the vital responsibilities that he does sustain, whether he likes it or not, to his children. Yes, he professes with his mouth to love his children. He says that he is concerned. He may even bring them to church, but he has no time for them, no energy, certainly not the best of his energies to expend upon them, to instruct and discipline them, and he rationalizes this neglect on the grounds of his busy schedule and his many pursuits. He salves his conscience and assumes he's somehow excused for shirking his paternal duties. I offer to you these are some additional reasons that may well make up the rationale for the apostles directing these two profound directives to fathers. Now again, note the language. In Ephesians 6:4, and fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. My concern now is to expound briefly the verb rendered in the NAS, do not provoke to anger. In the original, the term has the nuances of to rouse one to a settled state of anger, to drive one to a wrathful, irritable disposition. The picture, we can accurately say, is like this. It's the picture of a child with what could be called the normal tendency to anger possessed by any sinner. But by means of certain behaviors on the father's part, the child, incrementally over the years, is driven to a settled disposition of brooding irritability and wrath. The child's personality, as time goes on, becomes dominantly marked by an internal seething anger. Anger is cultivated by the parent and grows in the child such that it inordinately holds sway over a child's personality. In my understanding, that is the dominant distinction of this prohibition rendered, do not provoke to anger. I want to say, for the sake of balance, Paul is not issuing a prohibition that says, never make your child angry. He's not saying that. But he is prohibiting the creation of a kind of adversarial relationship between your children and yourself that has been created by your constant provocations of them. Now, to fill out our understanding of the prohibition, I turn to the parallel text in Colossians 3:21. And consider for a moment the parallel prohibition, which is rendered in the NAS, do not exasperate. It is a different term in the original. It has the nuance of stirring up, exciting, stimulating, arousing, and in the context, unto anger. Now one might ask, what is the distinction between the prohibition, do not provoke to anger, of Ephesians 6:4, and now the parallel prohibition of Colossians 3, do not exasperate. In my understanding, the distinctions as they combine can be set forth in this way. The verb in Ephesians 6:4 is emphasizing the settled state of wrath that comes to dominate the personality of the child, an established attitude of angry resentment, while the prohibition of Colossians 3:21 is emphasizing the means of getting there. The exciting, the constant inciting, the constant stimulating. We could say that the distinctives in nuance and understanding of these two prohibitions is something like this. Colossians 3:21, do not exasperate, has the particular nuance of indicating the means. The means being this arousing and this constant irritating by this behavior or that behavior. Whereas the words of Ephesians 6:4 convey the end of that process. Settled, angry resentment. Putting the two complementary prohibitions together, the apostolic warning in these two towering directives is to be on guard that you do not, by your words, by your attitudes, by your negligence, by your conduct, by your provocations, incrementally drive your child, incite your child to a settled attitude of resentment and bitterness. The prohibitions can be understood, fathers and mothers, in this way. Do not mar and warp and distort your child's attitude with a deep, brooding, settled anger towards you in particular and life in general. Now, continuing for a moment in Colossians 3:21, Paul says, fathers, do not exasperate your children that they may not lose heart. The verb rendered lose heart means most literally to give up. It has the associated senses of being discouraged, of being dispirited, disheartened, dejected, and downcast. The sense of the words that they may not lose heart can be likened unto the scene of the wind dying down upon the lake and the sails of the boat collapsing. We talk about taking the wind out of one's sails. That's the sense of the language that concludes Colossians 3:21. We talk about in our lingo taking the air out of a balloon. The balloon collapses and drops to the ground. That's something of the sense of the language, that they may not lose heart. That they may not lose heart contains the ideas of despondency. That is, losing hope that the child, the son or the daughter, can ever please you again. Losing hope, coming to a despondent disposition that any further efforts to please you are impossible. There is the sense of sullenness. Sullenness is a condition of silent resentment, often manifested in a refusal to be sociable, a refusal to be communicative. How many parents in our generation live with exactly that atmosphere in their homes between themselves and their children? The verb that they may not lose heart contains the idea or has the nuance of listlessness, a lack of drive, a lack of initiative, a lack of motivation. It has the sense of being unconcerned, having little regard, in this case, most particularly for one's parents, little regard perhaps for one's siblings, little regard for others and their needs, a lack of sensitivity, a lack of courtesy. The picture is of a child who has repeatedly been irritated, been incited by certain ways, in this case of a father, and at long last, the end result is that child is apathetic, is indifferent, has been broken in spirit with regard to the relationship between themselves and first and foremost their parents. Fathers, do not exasperate your children that they may not lose heart. In J. Adams' book, Christian Living in the Home, chapter 8, which is a chapter I would earnestly recommend to you for your reading, it's entitled Discipline with Dignity. J. Adams says, and I quote, "Exasperating children is a precise description of what happens so often in our day. Angry exasperation most clearly describes the prevalent attitude of rebellion among so many young people. No two words better describe the contemporary attitude than anger," referring to Ephesians 6:4, "mixed with exasperation," Colossians 3:21. "Youth have been losing heart with, giving up on, and writing off their parents' discipline in disgust." The picture, leaving the quotation, is that of young people who have turned their backs and closed their ears and minds to parental authority, and in time, quite possibly, to all authority, be it civil or ecclesiastical, authority in the schoolhouse or wherever. And thus, in their disheartened, apathetic, listless, rebellious state, they give themselves over to every type of self-destructive gratification as they pursue their own desires and pleasures. Yes, they are responsible for their self-destructive use of drugs and alcohol, for their self-destructive plunge into immorality, for their giving up on a decent appearance. They are responsible for their social withdrawal into a cocoon, being reclusive and verbally unresponsible. They are responsible for that result, but so are their fathers. Their fathers have been the means of driving them to it. Their detached, absentee parents, fathers in particular, who have incited them time and time and time again. And that's the end result. Well, in our final 30 minutes this morning, by way of application at this point, I want to raise and begin to answer, or at least with some suggested answers and responses, I want to raise the question, what parental behaviors provoke a child to anger? What parental behaviors exasperate that son or daughter such that generally in the teenage years, that son or daughter has written you off and may have just written life off altogether? Now, I want to pause before giving several responses to such a question by saying the suggestions that follow come from the counsel of others. And again, I would refer to J. Adams' book, Christian Living in the Home, the chapter in Wayne Mack's book, Strengthening Your Marriage, the chapter that deals with parenthood. These responses come from such sources as that. They come from my own observation over the years of parents, and sadly, they come from my own experience. It was with some frequency during the years that our son and daughter were under our roof that I would sit them down and ask them, "What am I doing to exasperate you?" And they had the fortitude to answer. And so those are the sources from which these suggestions have been derived. Again, the question, what parental behaviors violate these prohibitions? What parental behaviors incite unto the end that a child gives up on you and perhaps on life altogether? Number one, I suggest to you that unannounced rules that are made known only after the child has violated them. That's a primary source of provoking and exasperating her son or daughter. Now, to explain what I mean, a rather common illustration. Suppose, or how would you feel, if you were driving, perhaps one way or the other on I-64, and you were driving 65 miles an hour, and Mickey Kahn stops your car, pulls you over, writes you a ticket, says to you, "Sir or ma'am, you were speeding. Last week, the legislature in Kentucky changed the interstate speed limit from 65 back to 55. We haven't had time to post it yet, but it's the law and I must write you a ticket." Well, you'd feel the same way your child feels on those occasions when he or she is punished for violating rules previously unannounced or imprecisely and poorly explained. They feel that they have become the victims of arbitrary enforcement, that they are the victims of injustice. Perhaps your child wanders out of your yard and down the street, and you explode in a tirade of anger. But you had never instructed your child otherwise. Perhaps your son or daughter arrives home in an hour later than you would have liked, and you react, but you had never given precise instructions as to what the curfew was. Or maybe you instructed your son and daughter to go upstairs and clean the bedroom. An hour later, you enter that bedroom and find For instance, the bed unmade, or perhaps several dresser drawers halfway shut, and you erupt, and then you administer the rod, and yet you had never clarified, never explained what clean your bedroom meant. To your son or daughter, it could have well meant get the clothes off of the floor and put the toys away. And in their mind, they were following their understanding, and you had never clarified it, but you erupted and administered the rod anyway. Well, we could go on and on with what I mean by the sense of unannounced or imprecisely explained standards of conduct. I offer to you that that is a primary way, if you give yourself to it habitually, of provoking a child, and at length causing that child to give up. Secondly, I would strongly suggest with confidence that a second behavior that has the great potential of provoking a child and exasperating a child that he or she loses heart is inconsistency. And this is what I mean. Children need predictability in order to develop a healthy personality and to function well. They need to know the limits. They need to have the limits consistently enforced. But regrettably, predictability and consistency is rarely found in parents. For most children, this is the reality. The rules change from Monday to Tuesday, and Tuesday to Wednesday, and Wednesday to Thursday, and so on. Stated rules are enforced one day and ignored the next. Enforcement, quite sadly, is not related to principle, not related primarily to the violations of stated standards, but to a variety of realities in the parents, such as moods, convenience, or laziness. Some years ago, I viewed a video presentation that illustrated what I mean here by inconsistency, and it conveyed it in this manner. A father arrives home from work and is walking up the sidewalk, and as he does, he trips over his son's bicycle that was there in the middle of the sidewalk, and the father had repeatedly instructed him to put the bicycle away. Angered, he rushes into the house, yells for his son, administers the rod, and exiles him into his room until dinner. Well, the next day, and I might add, on that next day, the dad is informed he's going to be promoted and he's going to get a raise. He comes home, walks up the same sidewalk, trips over the same bicycle, but this time he gets up, brushes himself off, smiles, and thinks to himself, well, boys will be boys. Such inconsistency is bewildering to a child. The parent sets standards and punishments. The child breaks the standard once, and nothing happens. The child breaks the standard again, and down comes a storm of parental wrath. The child does not know where he or she stands. The child does not know if the parent is really serious or not. One day, something is apparently permissible. The next day, the very same thing seems to be prohibited. One day, he or she is spanked for an offense. The next day, he or she is ignored for the same offense. Such a display of inconsistency has the strong potential over the years under your roof to drive a child to anger and resentment, to ultimately bring that child to the disposition of giving up and saying, at least to himself or herself, what is the use? I never know where I stand. Such a system of fluctuating standards and enforcements, of being really attentive one week and negligent the next, will leave a child at length in a state of exasperation and frustration, just like it would lead you if you were dealt that way in the marketplace. We might ask, why is it that this issue of consistency seems to be such a major problem for parents? Why are parents so inconsistent? Why is their corrective discipline of their children marked by starts and stops, periods of enforcement, followed by sporadic enforcement, if any at all? I would offer quickly that some possible answers to such a question is, first, their selfishness. They are simply too busy with their own routines and schedules. They're doing what pleases them at the moment, and it's annoying to have to stop and to systematically and with principle and with wisdom and patience administer corrective discipline. Convenience is all too often what really determines discipline. If it's convenient, yes. If not, ignore it. Boys will be boys. Why are parents so inconsistent? Well, it also may be explained by their impatience. If they lay out a plan of corrective discipline today, and after 10 days they see no substantial improvement, they may be tempted to quit or at least to begin to back off. They forget that real change takes a while, even in their own lives. They also forget that they may be seeking to implement discipline after years of neglect. In their impatience, after a week or so, they give up and begin to go back to their old ways of ignoring rebellion and vainly pleading with it. Well, whatever the explanation, I offer to you in response to the question, what may be some of the parental behaviors that violate these serious prohibitions of Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21, I would offer to you by way of rather confident suggestion that inconsistency is near at the top of the list. Thirdly, I would offer to you that too many standards may drive a child to the same disposition at length. If you have dozens of rules and dozens of restrictions, you may think you are doing a fine job, but really that is seldom the case. Eventually, you turn into a kind of domestic detective in order to police all of the rules. Or, eventually, you'll fail to enforce many that you have made. Either eventuality is defeat and is bad. And the reaction of children to living with a domestic detective and living within this straitjacket of rules for everything is at length angry exasperation. It's much healthier for you and your child to set, as I've indicated on the little chart, four or five standards that are pressing at the moment, that are pressing in relevance and timeliness for this stage of development and maturity, and to work on them. And then, as one of those standards is internalized over some number of months or a year or whatever, and becomes a part of the habit and the character of your son or daughter, then you add another standard that becomes the focus of attention. And as I've suggested to our own parents on that little chart, always have prompt obedience as your catch-all and last standard. That covers everything. That covers those eventualities that occur at the spur of the moment that you could not have forecast. But the point is to have a manageable number, manageable for the maturity level, the degree of development of your son and daughter, manageable for you, 4 or 5, maybe 6 standards that are pressing, that are timely, that are appropriate to where your child is in life. And give yourself to the instruction, and if need be, to the corrective disciplinary response of them, and do so consistently without creating the climate of a police state in your home. Now, I would offer that there is a fourth suggestion that I believe is near the top of the list of potential. Another suggestion as to what parental behaviors may provoke a child, and I'll simply describe it as divided authority. Divided authority between father and mother. Husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, who disagree over standards and corrective responses or punishments, do so normally because they've simply never taken the time to confer with one another and reach agreement beforehand. Instead, they wait until it is too late and a violation has occurred. One spouse wants to bring down fire and brimstone, and the other thinks, "Don't do it again, Johnny," is sufficient. So what does Johnny begin to learn in time? Well, he begins to learn he can't really depend on either. He begins to learn how to play the game of playing one authority off against the other, of driving a larger and larger and more destructive wedge between father and mother. He becomes confused. Who should he listen to? Is dad or mom unjust? Dad or mom too hard, too lenient? Who really cares about me? That's the root question in an arrangement of divided authority. And there's only one solution. That solution is parental agreement, which takes conference time together. The solution is teamwork. The solution is ongoing mutual communication, ongoing mutual assessment of where your son or daughter is at any one time, what is up next upon the radar screen of development, what is timely, what is relevant, constant mutual assessment and evaluation. There is no simplistic sequence of standards, none that I've ever come across. God has given fathers and mothers to identify those things in the lives of their sons and daughters. Well, I offer to you that divided authority may exasperate a child. Fifthly, I would offer to you that flaunted and abusive authority may provoke a child and exasperate a child that they give up. Authority which is brandished with the arrogant attitude of, "I dare you to cross me." That's not discipline. That's just some kind of vain, arrogant, parental machoism. Authority without the undergirding of example. Without the undergirding and encompassing of paternal and maternal love. Authority that stands outside the orbit of relationship. I've had occasions, regrettably, to almost have to side with a rebellious child. Because the poor child only knew authority. No relationship. No context for the authority. no context for corrective discipline. Authority pictured when a father, as it were, puts on his domestic policeman badge, sheathes his rod, and goes marching through the house, bullying and barking his orders, making his angry threats and his claims to authority and his demands and his expectations. That's the picture of what I mean by flaunted and abusive authority. That's not discipline. That's not the biblical brand. That may be the brand, regrettably, that was featured in Time magazine some months ago at the Atlanta church. That's not biblical discipline. Further, what parental behaviors may provoke and exasperate a child? This next one, if I were reworking this series entirely, I may put in the number one spot. And it's this. The failure to distinguish between what must be enforced as a standard or a rule and what a child must be allowed to learn on his own. Now, to say this in other language before illustrating, it's my own observation that smothering a child with inordinate control, with inordinate mother hen protectionism, will drive the spirit right out of a child, particularly a boy. Hovering over and around them, never allowing them freedom to learn upon their own for fear that there's risk out there in the real world and my little son or daughter may fail. Your little son or daughter has got to learn to face failure. For fear of injury. That kind of smothering and cocooning that creates what we call in our lingo the mama's boy. Particularly the young man tied to his mother's apron strings. An emotionally crippled, dependent, fearful child who at length will never take the initiative. Does not know what an enterprising spirit is always to play it safer. God help you if you're satisfied with raising that kind. It's exhibit nearly number one of the language of exasperation and losing heart. Some years ago I read, and it may be in J. Adams' Christian Living in the Home or somewhere else, of an example of what I'm trying to communicate. He or some other author spoke of a parent knowing the distinction of their small child needing to learn to swing. And yes, your child may fall out right on his head. But at some point, your son or daughter needs to learn to get in the swing and swing by himself or herself. We're not talking when the child's 1 year old or 2 years old, but at a point when strength and equilibrium and the such are developed, the child needs to learn to swing. But there's a distinction between that and that same small child running across the kitchen to touch the pretty orange and blue flame on the stove. And what the author said, and I'm using it as an illustration of what I'm trying to convey, is that we must distinguish between swing issues and flame issues. We've got to let them go on their own when there's swing issues involved. Granted, we've got to intervene when there's flame issues. We've got to give them the freedom to learn despite risk. But on the other hand, there are flame issues, that is, rules to be enforced. And a wise parent has got to study his son or his daughter and at any given point in their development, understand the difference. Lest that parent be the smothering mother hen that at length takes the heart right out of a child. It's the difference, as I would illustrate, between allowing your son to learn to catch a baseball. Granted, sooner or later, he's going to take one in the eye. Sooner or later, he's going to take one in the head. Sooner or later, he's going to be down at second base and he's going to take cleats right in his calf. But he's got to learn. He's got to learn to catch a ball. But on the other hand, it was some of the foolish things I did when I was a kid, having BB gun battles with my buddies. That's a flame issue. Catching a ball is a swing issue. There's a difference between your son entering a swimming program at the local YMCA and learning to swim. Yes, your son or your daughter may drown. But your son or daughter needs to learn to swim. That's a swing issue. A flame issue is perhaps that same 6 or 7 year old running off unattended at the ocean. That's a rule to be enforced. A swing issue is an issue like learning to ride a bicycle. Sooner or later, your son or daughter's got to learn to ride a bicycle, and sooner or later, they're going to fall off. They're going to get cut. They're probably going to have to go to the hospital, get a few stitches. That's a part of growing up. But then there's the flame issue of foolishness in an automobile. That's a rule to be enforced. The traffic laws are not swing issues. They're flame issues. What I'm trying to convey is that a given father and mother with their son, their daughter, needs to so study and assess and evaluate that they know when they are to let out incrementally the tether, that they know when there has to be granted measured freedom to learn on one's own, to take risk. Such is necessary to a healthy maturity, to being able to function in the real world, to being able to face your own fears, to being able to get over your failures. Yes, your son or daughter is going to fail, and they got to learn to get beyond it. But if you smother them, if the philosophy of your home is always play it safe, no risk, well, you can just write Colossians 3:21, and just put it on your refrigerator, that's where you're heading. You'll raise a son or daughter who may never have a scar, but that son or daughter won't have a heart either. That son or daughter won't know what initiative, what a venturesome, enterprising, sanctified, risk-taking approach to life is. They'll get their hourly job, and they'll play it safe, perhaps right into retirement, and you wonder if they ever accomplished anything. I trust you're not satisfied with that kind of lifestyle. We've got to be able to distinguish between swing issues, they got to learn to swing, and flame issues, their rules to be enforced. And without that distinction, it's my judgment, strongly so, without that distinction being made in the instructing and disciplining of your children, you are going to exasperate them, and they will lose heart. Well, brethren, there are a host of other suggestions, but that's the one I wanted and planned to end upon. May God give us help now as we transition to an entirely different matter in the next hour. Let us pray. Father, we do cry out in our own inability and deficiencies for Your grace, for wisdom and perception, that we might be fathers and mothers, alertly and insightfully tuned in to our boys and girls, our sons and daughters, that we might not provoke and exasperate, and that we might bring them up in the discipline and in the formative instruction of the Lord unto the end, that they might be competent, Christ-like men and women of God. Lord, may that be our vision. And may we invest ourselves as the means to see that vision for which we pray fulfilled. We ask in the name of Christ. Amen.